Hey guys, don't forget the 2023 Street Cop Training Conference, Nashville, Tennessee, April 23rd through the 28th. You do not want to miss this. So far, guest speakers, Rob O'Neill, the Navy SEAL that was responsible for killing Osama bin Laden, Kyle Carpenter, U.S. Marine, Medal of Honor recipient, jumping on an IED to protect his platoon. Fox News host Tommy Lahren returns for 2023. Sheriff Wayne Ivey, Sheriff Mark Lamb, Sheriff David Clark, and more to come. You don't want to miss this event. We additionally have 20 of the country's top law enforcement educators giving you the best experience of your life. You will leave this event knowing more about your job and how to be proficient at the things you do, hands down, any other event that you'll ever attend. I personally guarantee it. Don't miss out. There's a room code at streetcop.com for our room block and room code at the Gaylord at Opry is where the event's taking place. Don't miss out on a discounted rate. The rate is from Sunday to Thursday. Put that in and find yourselves at a half-price room. Split it with a friend, but make sure you get there. You don't want to miss this event. It is going to be that good. If you trust me and you trust Street Cop, trust that you will leave there feeling like you've had an experience of a lifetime.
You training to be a street cop?
Well, Clint, what do you want to talk about today?
Whatever you want. I'm game for anything.
If you want to stay off certain topics because they're redundant to speak about, because I know that now having so many fucking Navy SEAL friends, they're like, everybody wants to know about buds. Like, is that the most common thing people ask you about buds?
It is. And it's, I get it. Like you get, I personally get used to it. You know, it's like, whatever you want to know, I'll tell you. I'll probably tell you things that, you know, other people may have forgotten. You never know what you get out of it when you ask each guy. That's the thing. Buds is interesting because there's things that I had forgotten at the time, but comes back later. Right. And you're like,
in therapy sessions,
almost. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of how it is. You compartmentalize and shut certain aspects of it out. You know, not because it was, I mean, I guess it could be considered traumatic, but I think it's just because you're so sleep deprived, most of it, that the memory actually doesn't come back till later. Cause in those moments, you're just like a zombie trying to get through it. You know,
why don't you give everybody your bio, man? Tell us who you are.
I'm Clint Emerson, a retired team guy, as you've already identified, and now a crisis management professional. And I write some books.
Boy, is that the most humble fucking bio I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah.
Because, dude, I mean, there's got to be 9,000 minutes of filler in between just that. I mean, I know you grew up in Saudi Arabia, all this crazy shit. Let's go into some of that stuff to start and how you ended up in the military. And then, you know, to downplay crisis management and crisis intervention, I'm sure you're doing some profound work there. I'd like to unpack some of that stuff as well, because we face it undoubtedly in our lives as well. So let's do that. Let's start from the beginning. Tell me about what it was like when you were three. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, go through some of that stuff, man.
Yeah. I mean, the Saudi aspect, my dad got a job with Aramco, which is the biggest oil company in the world. It's owned by Saudi Arabia. We moved over there when I was probably 8 years old and I stayed till high school. So growing up in a very radical Islamic state, you know, kind of like
do you speak Islam or Muslim? I don't know what's the language, or Saudi Arabia.
Arabic, you know.
Arabic. Do you speak it?
It's mandatory to take it. You know, I can abla from time to time. I understand it better than I can speak it, because if you're not doing it, then you're not going to be good at it.
Wow.
But yeah, I know if they're talking shit or if they're saying something that, you know, is derogatory, because it, you know, I still remember all the bad words. So, growing up there, I try to always tell people, like, you know, it left like this kind of bad taste in my mouth. And it's probably what gave me the passion and drive, you know, to get through buds and actually be a SEAL. You know, it's interesting what influences you as a child. You know, it really becomes part of you, and it's hard to shake no matter how old you get. Right. So, you know, I've had moments, then, you know, you fast forward in Iraq and I saw this little girl that was looking at me the same way I used to look at Muslim men whenever they'd mistreat my dad or my mom or whatever. And I realized, wow, you know, me seeing what I saw led me to the path that I took. Now imagine these kids in these countries that saw us, you know, rolling through their villages. And I can only imagine when they don't have many other options that, you know, they want to, they're saying the same thing to themselves that I used to say, right? Like, man, when I grow up, I'm going to fucking kill these people. So, you know, it's some things go full circle. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I we'll go down that road, I guess, a little bit. As you were saying that, I'm like, man, he really got some payback. And the ultimate came back, got prepared and went back and like, fuck you, dude. Right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, obviously on the right side of the law is always a good thing. But anyway, got done with Saudi, came back to the States, went to high school, then college. I always had the itch to be a SEAL. So I, you know, I ended up joining, signing the dotted line, and then off I went. I went to Navy boot camp first. That's how it was back then. You went to boot camp, then you went to an A school, which gave you a job. I picked corpsman, which is a medic. That way, if you don't make it through BUDS, you have a job that you can do in the Navy. So it used to be a requirement before you go to BUDS to actually have a rating. Now you can go into boot camp, go straight to BUDS. And if you don't make it, I think they have an option where you can actually get out. But
wow.
Anyway, I went through A school for corpsman. That's 3 months, then checked into BUDS and you know, started with 203, finished with 203. I'm sure you've heard guys say that, you know, because it's a big deal when you start and finish with the class, your same class, because there's so many guys that get injured or get rolled back for different reasons. So when you're part of that original crew, it's like it's a unique little, it's like an asterisk right next to your name that you actually started and finished with your original class. We had 180 guys, and then I think we finished with 27 originals or something like that.
Wow.
But we had roll-ins. So my graduating class ended up being around, I think, double that, probably around 40. Yeah. And then went to SEAL Team 3, and then went to 18 Delta, which is, you know, our special operations medical school. And then back to Team 3, got to do a bunch of deployments. Then went to the NSA, then went to Dev Group, and then retired. And now here I am chatting with you.
Dude, so were you a medic the whole time on the SEAL team?
Yeah, the first half of my career, I maintained all those quals. You know, you're a shooter first, and then you've got, everyone has a job that they do second, right? So yeah, I tried to maintain quals as long as I could until I jumped over to more of the covert clandestine world. Then I lost those skills because I was having to maintain a whole other set of stuff that there just wasn't enough time on the calendar to be maintaining everything.
Do you still maintain that knowledge base? Like if something kicks off, your medic go just kicks back in, you're ready to do some shit.
It is pretty amazing that, you know, 18 Delta is run by the Army, and it's one of the best medical courses probably in the world. I mean, it really does a good job making, you know, the education muscle memory, you know, to this day, you know, when you're memorizing all the drugs, I can tell you like atropine, it competes with acetylcholine at the receptor side of the synapsis in order to reduce parasympathetic response, right?
Wow.
So for every drug you memorize, like what does that drug do? It's pretty amazing how much actually sticks with you just like that. I haven't said that in forever. But, you know, primary, secondary assessments, knowing exactly what to do and how to do it. Now, what I know is much different than the current guys, right? They've got so much better, like, you know, the medical technology's come such a long ways that I'm not up to speed on any of that. But the basics are always remain the same for the most part.
Did you ever have to employ your medical abilities in the field?
I did a couple of times, you know, admin illness and sicknesses with guys, you know, no matter where we were in the world, combat, you know, you get none of my guys, but some Marines that were shot up by myself and Glenn Doherty, you know, plugged some of their holes. Glenn, you know, everybody knows that name. He died in Benghazi, him and Ty. But Glenn and I was primary. He was secondary medic in one of our deployments together. So I've had to do, I mean, every SEAL medic I know, you've got trauma experience, because if you don't get it on the battlefield, then part of our, in order to maintain your qualifications, you have to go do rotations. So we work at major hospitals across the country with almost the same scope of practice as a ER doc. So when we show up, usually only the head doctor of a emergency room knows that we're not actually, we don't actually have MD behind our name, but everybody else, the nurses and interns and residents, everybody that's in there thinks we're doctors and they don't ask. And we get to actually run full, you know, trauma profiles when patients come through the door of ERs. We also will also, for our paramedic stuff, we do runs on ambulances. And so we're right there with, we'll, you know, I hung out with like the San Diego Fire Department for several months straight, sleeping in the firehouse, going on every call with those guys, and then getting all that hands-on training. And then the other piece that we do is Indian reservations. So we'll go work on a reservation and provide, you know, medical assistance in their clinics, which is always interesting, right? Because they like to drink and stab each other. So you get, you're always guaranteed to have stab wounds. And then on the dental side, we're, you know, we do that too. You know, I've pulled teeth and all kinds of stuff. So anyway, you do a lot. You know, if you're maintaining your quals, then you end up actually going and doing a lot of stuff, whether it's real world in the United States for training or real world overseas, you know, combat, or, you know, like I said, disease processes that your own guys will face. You know, I've had to treat dengue fever, malaria, you know, different kinds of staph and strep infections. And I even had one buddy, you know, we were building breaching charges and using a skill saw, instead of putting it down to cut the board, he held it up, right? And he's holding that board and he's got the skill saw, and that skill saw took off and ran right over his thumb, right? And I was standing right there, watched. I was like, dude, that thing's going to, and then he took his thumb off. So, you know, I've scrubbed in and sewn thumbs back on. You know, it's like, there's always something, you know, you can count on frogmen, you know, breaking themselves on a regular basis.
Wow, dude.
Yeah.
That's interesting shit.
Yeah.
Did you like the medical side of things?
I did. Yeah. I've always enjoyed it. Even as a kid, I was over in Saudi. They actually had the Boy Scouts, right? So, I remember the first exposure was, you know, like the first aid merit badge, and I liked it. I had no idea how interested I was until I did that merit badge. And then, you know, and then I always thought, well, maybe I'll go some medical path in life, you know, but yeah, it ended up kind of happening anyway, even as a SEAL.
You know, this morning when I woke up, I was reminded that it is Veterans Day and that I was going to speak to you today. And I just want to say, you know, thank you, man. I don't know how to express that enough. It's so genuine in my heart. I know so many men and women from doing this for as long as I have in the profession that I'm in. I've heard the stories. I try to really put myself in at least what would it have felt like to have been in some of the situations you've been in. And it doesn't even do it justice or service, but I don't think people realize the sacrifice that these human beings have made for us. And man, I can't thank you enough for everything you've done. And that's everybody across the board. And, you know, the fact that you had a relationship with the Benghazi people involved and lost their lives during that incident, it speaks volumes of the pain that you probably have to live with for the rest of your life, knowing that a friend of yours lost his life in such a horrific way. Oh. And, you know, so thank you.
No, thank you, man. Thanks for your service, too. I appreciate that. I really do.
You know,
you guys have to deal with your own fair amount of crap that most people don't get or understand either. So, you know, thank you.
You know, I it's different. And I was actually able to at least go home at night after police academy. And I had to go deal with things maybe for 4 days, but I'd be off for 4 days and get to see my friends and family and be in touch with them. But my neighbor around the corner from me, he's actually a field surgeon. You know, he's got kids that are same age as my kids, and he leaves. His name's Vance Moss. Him and his brother are both, you could actually Google them. They've been on like Dr. Oz and all this other crazy shit. Vance is my boy. I love him to death. And he's 51 years old and he's still getting deployed out for 3, 6, 9 months. I don't know where he was last time. He just got back a couple weeks ago. And I watch the sacrifice this man has to go through. And every time I see him, I go, bro, I can't thank you enough, man. Like, I know people don't realize what you're going through, but I see it in your kids. I see it in your wife. You know, I'm always here for them. They know that. And, you know, he's a good dude. He's a fucking good dude. He's a hell of an American. And, you know, 51 years old, still getting deployed out into the battlefield.
Yeah, the medical corps across the board in the military doesn't get enough, not enough pat on the backs, right? A lot of times when it comes to media, they focus on the sexy stuff, you know, special operations, you know, jets, aircraft carriers. I mean, that's all cool because it looks cool and it sounds cool. But the medical corps, I mean, they see everything on the hour, every hour when they're over there. So yeah, that's a, they are in itself a different breed and they do a great job. I mean, you know, military medicine is some of the best in, you know, in the world, and it leading the way for civilian doctors to follow a lot of times, especially when we're at war. Now, if we're in peacetime long enough, I might not go to a military hospital, but as long as we're overseas and those guys are getting the experience that they've got, I mean, yeah, you're basically getting treated by some of the best, most experienced guys in the world. But, you know, of course, the VA catches shit, you know, especially when if there's no wars going on, let's say in 10 years from now and you go to a VA, you might not be as impressed. You know what I mean?
Yeah, dude, for sure. Yeah. I guess you're just not getting the practice in, right?
That's right. As long as they're practicing.
It's a shitty way to have to practice, because I imagine it's got to be some of the most horrific things psychologically to endure. Oh, yeah. I'm a very compassionate man. I just thank the Lord for sparing me from a lot of the things that a lot of people have had to endure. Even as a cop, I was fortunate enough to never really, I don't know how I had the luck of a draw. I worked in a very busy police agency. I've since then retired. But I was fortunate enough to never have to go see a dead kid. Right. I'm glad. And at the time I didn't have kids, now I have four. I'm just glad. And I'm real sorry for those of you who have had to deal with that in the audience here. And that's why we talk about, like, you know, it's okay to not be okay. People have to recognize that you're a human being and the brain can only handle so much. Different levels of trauma for different people. I'm sure you've seen really horrific shit. The brain was not designed to see these things. We do a good job of compartmentalizing, like you've said, and stowing this shit. But you got to be careful with that stuff. And I'm sure we're going to get into some of that conversation in a little bit. But for those of you out there who are in the audience of this podcast, don't think that stuff's going to go away if you keep shoving it down. Things you have to start to unpack and mitigate. You've got to try to sort some of that shit out, because it'll build, and you'll lose your whole fucking life over it. So.
Yeah, that's no joke. You got to talk. I talk about it all the time. You know, I feel like that's the healthy approach. Tell stories. It keeps memories alive, but it also helps, you know, it's therapy in itself, obviously, just talking out loud about it.
Tell me about some of the crisis work you're doing.
It's kind of interesting how I got there. I never saw myself as being a crisis management guy. My job when I was on the East Coast, you know, as mentioned before, was a little more on the covert side. And specifically, it was CMOE, which is clandestine methods of entry. So that's basically getting in and out of targets without, you know, zero forensic trace back, zero attribution to the United States government. Okay. And through that, you know, when you're dealing with alarm systems and different perimeters and sensors and everything else that you could potentially face these days out there, I would go to these big global, like, security conferences. And I was going as a predator, right? I'm going because I want to learn and talk to all the companies that provide the different kinds of security technology. And then once you learn it, then I can go, all right, now how do I defeat it? So that if I run into it overseas, then I'll be good to go and be successful. And knowing that most of the world comes to these big security conferences, you can assume that the best practices, whether they're here in the US or abroad, are going to be kind of sort of the same. And so I use those moments as education so I could be, you know, better at what I was doing. In doing that, you end up seeing a lot of corporate guys, global security directors, and start learning about all these different jobs that are out there. And I was like, huh, Maybe that's something I can get into when I retire, right? Be a global security director for a Fortune 500, making 500 grand plus a year. That'd be cool. So I started taking all the classes and courses and getting all these certifications and while I was still in the Navy. And then, but I started seeing some loops or some holes and some gaps in everything that they were doing. And interestingly enough, it was all on like this more boring side. There was no, most companies, they're like, policy? What do you mean? We got to have policy on crisis management. It's like, well, yeah. Or training their workforce properly, or tools that could be provided to make everything a little easier if there is a crisis or to prevent the crisis. So anyway, I ended up putting together a little book called Escape the Wolf. And it was really about, you know, global travel and staying safe. And it got passed around through like government contractors and eventually ended up in the hands of a retired FBI guy. And he calls me and says, keep in mind, I'm still in the Navy. And he's like, I read this little pamphlet you built. I want you to teach that to all of my journalists. And I'm like, well, who do you work for? And he's like, the Wall Street Journal. I was like, oh, I never thought about that. So what do you want me to do? And he's like, make it, turn it into e-learning. And I'm like, well, what the hell is e-learning? So, you know, before you know it, I'm taking my little self-built book, you know, self-published little handout, and I'm going to a developer, you know, that back then, you know, trying to find somebody who develops e-learning for a living was actually kind of difficult because it's been 10 plus years. But anyway, I found him, and the guy was like, yeah, it'll cost you $60,000 to turn this into e-learning. And I had a USA credit card I've only used, you know, for work that had a $50,000 limit. And I said, well, hey, how about 50,000? Because that's all I got on this thing. And he's like, okay. Right. So max out my credit card. Don't even have a contract with the Wall Street Journal. And 6 months goes by, 50 grand later, I call up this guy. And it's getting really close to me getting out of the Navy. So it's timing wise, it was all like working out. And I was like, man, this is actually, who would have thought I could actually get out and do this for a living? And I called Joe back up. I'm like, hey, that e-learning you requested, it's done. He's like, all right, let me look at it. He looked at it, he loved it. It was very interactive. Back then it was all about the adult learning criteria back then. As it related to e-learning is, hey, you got to make it GUI, you got to make it clickable, you got to make it interactive on the screen so that the people pay attention. These days, e-learning is just videos, right? But back then, you were actually doing all this crazy stuff on the screen and using your cursor. That's all since come and gone. But anyway, he liked it. And then he was like, how much? I'm like, oh, man, I don't know. How much money you got? You're the Wall Street Journal. I mean, I don't know how to charge for this stuff. And he's like, are you kidding me? Like, send me an invoice and let's get this going. I was like, okay. So anyway, I sold it to them. And
did you do well on a sale? You don't got to see the numbers. Did you do well?
No, all I did was double it. I sold it for a hundred grand, took 50, obviously paid off my credit card, took the other 50, thought I was rich. And, you know, I'm a Navy guy, a Navy salary. So, you know, it was horrible. It was like, I should have, you know, now any of the stuff I sell now is a license, right? And you have no idea how many clients I've built stuff for that I didn't make it a license. And then a light bulb went off, you know, sometime, you know, how many ever years ago, like, wait a minute, why am I not licensing my stuff? With a monthly rate or an annual rate, you know? Mm-hmm. And anyway, I've learned a lot of lessons in business, but crisis management is definitely a lot of fun. I like it. It's still kind of like serving and providing to people, which I enjoy. So there you go.
It's so interesting that you said you've learned a lot of lessons in business. I actually wrote already, what are some of the best life lessons you've learned? I've written that down, but let's start with business lessons, because at times this is a crossover between, you know, we're really a potpourri of topics here. Secretly, maybe publicly more now, I love business. I fucking love it. Like, this is my thing. People are like, oh, you should get a hobby. I'm like, motherfucker, this is my hobby, right? Like, you want to do something good with me on a Sunday. Let's go to a fucking conference where I can hear. I was at a conference last week with two significant, well-known entrepreneurs, Ed Mylett and Andy Frisella, where they spoke. It's called the Arte Syndicate. And dude, I was there. It was like, I was actually getting emotional during it. I'm like, fuck, this is like my soul. One of the we have one of their keynotes that did the event coming on the podcast in a couple of weeks. When I was there, I sent it to Frankie, our podcast, which I'm like, hey, get this guy on the show. So he was really excited to be asked to be on the podcast, which is great because it's cool to be doing this kind of work. But
yeah,
selfishly, I'm going to ask you about what are some of the business lessons you've learned? We'll start with that one. Tell me about some of those business lessons you've learned.
Well, I think, you know, the first one obviously is you're going to take risks, take the risk. Don't be scared to, you know, put all that money on you, right? On yourself. I think, you know, if there was any, anything I've learned the most was investing in myself, betting on myself has always ended up being the better route. And I've tried a lot of different routes. I've put my trust into, you know, these Hollywood guys as it related to my podcast, totally got fucked over. I've put my trust in, you know, some other things thinking, yeah, it'll all work out in the end. I'm still young. It's okay if it doesn't work. And then of course it doesn't work. And it's always, you're always blindsided by, it's like something you just couldn't predict. Right. And you know, don't rely too much on hope, right? Hope really isn't a good plan. And I think that some people will bet on themselves and then hope for the best, but you still have to have a plan. So don't rely on hope would probably be number two, because I did that plenty of times. I hope that they would be good people. I hope that this idea would work. I hope. But yeah, it just, it never works. Make sure you plan it all out. You think it through. You vet it through other like-minded individuals or people with more experience. And don't be scared to, you know, throw it in the trash, which leads to number three, never fall in love with anything you're doing, right? We have in the intelligence community, it's never fall in love with your source. And it doesn't mean in like a romantic way. It means you really do. If you're collecting information and you've got someone, you really like them. Maybe you even feel sorry for them and you're paying them for information. It's real easy to just keep paying them, even though the information starts to become stale, sucks, or isn't accurate any longer. So same thing applies with your own ideas. Don't fall in love with them. Don't keep investing in them. If it isn't doing what you wanted it to do, you have to stay unemotional and be ready to shit can that idea or that concept like in a heartbeat, right? Because it's real easy to just keep going with it because you watch, you know, fucking social media and it tells you never to quit or some bullshit. But there are such things as just bad ideas, you know? And so that doesn't mean quit everything. It just means quit that stupid idea and move on to the next idea and keep going, keep moving forward, right? So, I mean, those are kind of just randomly as I sit here and blab the three that I think, you know, invest in yourself, bet on yourself, don't rely on hope. And if it's a bad idea, shit can it and move on to the next one.
Well, dude, my second part of that question was, what are some of the best life lessons you've learned? Like, and this is like, you could tell me about when your grandpappy was sitting on a fucking porch with you, you were shooting tin cans off a fucking fence and he leans over and tells you something fucking profound that stuck with you for life. Or you met some nurse somewhere and da da da. Who knows? I mean, some of the weirdest shit that's happened in my life. Some of the best advice I've ever gotten from people, like I didn't even know who the fuck they were.
Yeah, no, I've got some of those. My dad is the first one that sticks, you know, and I think every dad has probably told their kids something like this in different formats, variations, but his was, hey, you know, find your passion. You know, once you find your passion, you'll inevitably be good at it, whatever it is. And then the money will follow. Right. And we were just having a talk about making money. Right. And that was it. He's like, don't worry about the money. Find your passion. If you're passionate about it, you'll be good at it. And if you're good at it, the money will follow. Another one that I got, I was at a party in La Jolla. It was La Jolla is a very wealthy area of San Diego. And I was still in the teams, went to some event party at this rich guy's house. And there was an older guy there. His name is Alan Glick. Alan Glick is the real life Robert De Niro in the movie Casino. Okay. That is in real life, the guy that made all the money for the mob in Las Vegas. His name is Alan Glick, and he lives in a bulletproof house in La Jolla. And so somehow I end up in a conversation with this guy and talking about investments. And he's like, Clint, there's one thing I could tell you is invest in God stocks. And I'm like, what are God stocks? Real estate, gold, and oil. That's how you diversify. And when one is down, two of them will always be up. So the odds will always be on your side with God stocks. Like, that's actually kind of interesting. And if you pay attention to oil, real estate, gold, he's right. I mean, it's like, and so when you look at investing, whether it's the stock market or whatever, you know, take a moment and see if your money's going into any of those three big areas, because man, you know, that little bit of advice certainly has benefited me over the years. And I didn't have a lot of money to play with being in the Navy, but I had enough to like, go, all right, I can turn 10,000 bucks into something far more. And it works. It works like a charm. Doesn't matter what's going on in the world, politics, you know, whatever. Obviously all those things drive those three different verticals up and down. But the beauty of it is that usually there's always two that are high and only one that is low, right? And heck, right now, I think all three of them are at the highest they've ever been, right? Real estate, oil, and gold.
Let's go to number three. You gave me two.
Yeah.
Number three life lesson. Clint Emerson. Everybody, take a deep breath in. Clint's going to fire this motherfucker out.
I don't know about that.
Let's do it, Clint.
And the other one is really, the other one, I mean, through whether it's through the military or even out here in the civilian sector, it's you know, keeping it simple, right? I say it all the time, keep it simple, because the crisis in your life will complicate the rest, right? And it's whether you're about to, you know, get creative on how you're going to fuck with some bad guy overseas, or you know, dealing with, you know, a family issue right here at home, keeping it simple sure as hell makes the whole thing a lot easier. And because usually whatever is going on in your life, whether you're planning an operation or you're dealing with, you know, family emergency, it's real easy to get distracted by static and white noise and everything else going on around it. But try to always just keep it simple. Because usually what's going on around you will complicate the rest. There's no need for you to complicate it all on your own. And yeah, off the top of my head, those are my big three.
Maybe you can elaborate a little bit more on the last, on number three, and maybe try to give us an analogy or a real life scenario where that would be applicable. So
yeah, it's anchored to a saying that's in the military specifically, and you know, and special operations, and that is, if you master the basics, you'll be advanced, right? What makes us advanced at things is mastering the basics. And that in itself is keeping it simple, right? Like if I'm going to be a professional shooter and that's my job, then I am going to just solely concentrate on making sure my rounds are as accurate and as effective as possible, right? When I shoot. And really, when you break down how to do that, it's not because you've got lasers and night vision, all of this shit, you know, that's all helpful, but that's not what makes you a good shooter. That's not what makes you professional. What makes you professional is being able to do the same exact thing without the technology, right? Iron sights and still drilling holes and keyholing your shots. And the way you do that is really just mastering those basics, right? You know, if it's a rifle, you got that, you know, good cheek well, you've got a good sight picture, you still got that front sight focus, and you squeeze the trigger. And that doesn't change ever. You know, that those things are always the same. And those are all the most simple, basic parts and pieces to being a shooter. That, and I'm just using that as one example, right? I mean, it just applies to everything, because at the end of the day, when there are so many things we have to deal with and face, you know, some, you know, every minute, every couple of minutes, every hour, every day, if you were to complicate all the things that you're dealing with, I mean, you would get nothing done, right? I mean, it's just as anybody living their life, if you just look at everything, just keep it simple, keep it simple, keep it simple, right? Because when you add all that up, that's a pretty complicated day. So break it down, tackle the simple stuff, and usually it'll solve some problems for you.
Life is always going to be complicated, no question about it.
Yeah.
It's how you deal with life and how you react to the situation is the definition of one's true character, for sure.
Yeah, I think so. And it's real easy to get emotional and stress out. But I find and have found that if you just break it all down to its most simplest form, you'll be just fine. And you'll get through whatever that is a whole lot smoother.
I don't know about everything that you're allowed to talk about, and I do want to bring up a combat situation and elaborate off of what you just said about, you know, since we're talking about shooting in that context. Remember when I was a younger recruit many, many years ago, and I say that like I'm 103, I'm talking like 18, 20 years ago. We had a guy, I went to three police academies. We had a guy in one of the police academies who came in. He had been in three officer-involved shootings. And I think I asked him, I said, you know, what was the one thing that allowed you to win those three battles? He goes, you know, it may sound kind of simple and may sound stupid. It may actually baffle you what that is. He's like, but if you actually stop and aim, or you can remember to aim during the gun battle, you're probably going to win it. He goes, and that's where people fuck up. He's like, the situation takes over. You lose all sight of what you've learned, your principles, marksmanship. He goes, I won because I aimed. And it was just that simple. I've heard that from a lot of people who are involved in special forces and combat. Do you have any similar stories like that? Did you get deployed, engage in some kind of combat? And if you didn't, it's fine. You don't want to talk about it. It's fine as well. I know that things are sensitive in some parts, but I've heard from other military guys like, yeah, the first time you're in gun battle, you're fucking like a maniac. And then you realize, you start calming down and realize what's actually going to win the gunfight is that those following those principles, like you just said, it's aiming, slow, methodical, not being overexcited. Tell me about that a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with all that you've just said, but I relate it to time, right? Time can either be an adversary or it can be an ally. And when you're in those moments, if that's, you know, for me, I remember one moment when you're ambushed and you're taking on fire, you don't feel like you're moving fast enough. In fact, it feels like you're in slow motion reacting, and in the middle of what is probably split seconds, it feels like minutes. It's crazy, right? You can't hit the deck fast enough. You can't get on your gun fast enough, right? I mean, it is like everything goes a slow motion, and all you're thinking about is, I'm going to get shot because I feel like I'm not moving that fast, when in reality you are, right? And so it's remembering that, hey, when you feel like you don't have time, you actually do. And you just have to concentrate on taking that moment. And what seems like an eternity sometimes, right? Getting a good sight picture, depending on, you know, the position you're in, whether or not, you know, you're in whatever climate you're in, the conditions, the wind's blowing, there's a fucking chamal and there's sand everywhere. I mean, you still feel like this is taking forever. But because you've been training and you know on the range, when you've got the timers going, you're good. You know you're actually pretty fast, but it just doesn't feel that way in those moments of stress. It feels like you're moving really, really slow. At least that's my experience. And then finally, you get that sight picture and you're pulling the trigger. And interestingly enough, at the beginning of the war, when we were running green tips for everything, you know, there was one guy, I think we shot, you were shooting. And he wasn't dropping. You wanted to stop and like, look at your gun. Like, what the fuck is wrong with this thing? You know? And then eventually he drops, and there were some other guys, but you know, that particular one is the one I was concentrating on at that moment. But when we went over and kind of did a real quick battle damage assessment, you know, a couple of us were saying like, why the fuck do these guys, it was like they were, you know, you would have thought they were wearing body armor or something. But it wasn't until later we realized the green tips are flying so fast. They're so hot that a lot of bad guys had no idea they'd been shot. Right. Big part of being shot, and I'm sure you've seen this, is like it's a psychological thing. If you see it, right, you feel it or see it, then your mind takes over and you go, oh my God, I'm going to die. And you fall on the ground, and you start crying and, you know, start freaking out. But if you don't know what's happening, because it's zipping through you so fast, especially your torso, like these guys were still creeping, right? It's at night. They got their AK-47s and they're like creeping and we're shooting them and they're still creeping like this, walking. You know, it's like, what the hell? But yeah, anyway, it's kind of got off tangent, but it was just an interesting something that I think the entire military noted at the beginning is those green tips flying so fast that you shoot somebody 11 times and they still didn't drop because they just didn't know, right? It took, you know, probably 11 to 20, maybe 30 seconds for him to finally feel the effects of the bullets going through him and drop dead. But at the time, you're like, why the hell is it this guy just dropping as soon as one bullet hits him? Strange. But anyway, I think time is the one thing that can really, no matter what you're doing, make a great day better or make a good day bad. Right. It's all on if time's your friend or foe.
There's a lot of value in what you just said for police officers who are listening to this and even crossing over to the military side of things, that it's interesting that people, when they're shot, have that thought process of, oh my God, I'm going to die, which I'm certainly not downplaying what that must be. I've never been shot. I hope nobody has to get shot.
Yeah.
But I think there's an interesting learning curve here of, if you can psychologically get your brain to understand that, like, so what, I'm fucking shot, who cares? Let's keep going. That's probably the stuff that's going to keep you alive, or at least destroy your adversary, because you're buying yourself a lot more time at that point. You know, it's interesting. It's an interesting thing. And we have a lot of men and women who have been shot in the line of duty that come on this podcast, and we get to learn a lot from them. Unfortunately, they've had to experience that, and it fucking sucks. And who the fuck might even comment on their behalf of what it is? And just disturbing for me as a human being to hear our men and women who are, in my opinion, some of the best human beings on earth, to have to be enduring some of this insanity that comes along with doing this job or having a military job in special forces. But I think people can learn a lot from you sharing that insight and that gift of what you experience and how we can take it. This might be a weird question, but, and I don't know if you're willing to admit it, were you ever scared?
Oh, of course. I talk about fear all the time. I mean, scared, you know, that's one of those words that it's just a word thing, right? I mean, fear in itself is like fuel, you know, for a lot of us. I don't think you'll meet any experienced team guys that'll tell you, no, I'm not scared of anything. But it's really, I mean, in that world, fear is what keeps you safe, right? Meaning procedurally. It's fear that'll make you check and double check things, or, you know, especially like air operations before you jump out of an aircraft, right? I mean, especially if it's been a while, there's no one that, you know, no matter how many jumps you've got, if it's been a little while, it's time to jump out again. You get that little like reminder, like, oh, I'm jumping out of an airplane, right? It's that pucker factor. When you're jumping all the time, you still kind of have it, but you know, you're not as sensitive, I guess is probably the word. But yeah, I mean, I think fear can do a lot for you, you know. And I feel like there's people that say they don't fear anything. Then there's people that become that way. And when you become like truly fearless, just a lack of it completely, then you probably are going to be really unsafe. Right. In the two big things you measure a frogman by is performance and safety. They go hand in hand, whether it's in training and definitely in real world stuff. Right. I mean, that's the safety piece is driven by that little bit of fear that exists in all of us.
We had Nick Lavery on. I don't know if you're familiar with who Nick is. He was a special forces guy. And he was actually, I think he's the only amputee to ever return to Special Forces in the history of the United States.
Missing a leg, right? He's missing a leg. Yeah.
Nick's a fucking cool ass dude from Boston. He's a ginormous human being. And he talked about complacency is what caused his injury. It was at a point where he had done so many missions that he left his AR or his rifle, for the lack of a better description of what model it was, and violated safety protocol. And essentially cost a lot of people their lives and almost cost him his life. But certainly cost him a lot of pain, anger, anguish. Do you see complacency at all? And what is the detriment? What is the price that you'll pay for complacency?
Oh man. Yeah. I mean, you're going to see it, especially when if you're going all the time, everyone's going to have a little bit of complacency. But that's, you know, when you're part of a team, it's each other's job to kind of to put each other in check. Right. And so being a good leader, regardless of rank, is definitely key. And in our world, everyone's a leader, right? You know, complacency, the term like complacency kills, it does. There's no doubt about it. But I think as long as everyone's looking out for one another, you can reduce it to almost zero. But it does, it is a little bit of a teamwork deal, especially when you're working like a deployment. It's 6 months to a year of just constantly working, you know, and everyone's tired, everyone's run down, then complacency is going to creep in. And having your wits about you and making sure you're checking, double checking, and following all the procedures that you did in training is what's going to defeat it. You know, that muscle memory is what's going to keep complacency in check.
Man, I bet we could talk for days. Tell us about the books you wrote, where we can find them, where people can find you on social media, all that shit.
ClintEmerson.com is my little headquarters for my ecosystem. I'm probably on Instagram more than anything else. And books are all on Amazon, bookstores near you if you don't like Amazon. You know, my very first book that I alluded to is Escape the Wolf, self-published. I just reissued it. I basically updated it and did a new edition that just came out, I think like last month or something. And then, yeah, all my books are all about giving you skills. That's my goal. I think everyone needs to be self-reliant and skilled, whether it's knowing that it might take a minute for 911 to show up, all the way to, hey, all these supply chain issues. Guess what? If you're doing it yourself, then you're not affected by all the crazy bullshit going on this planet. So I just want people to start doing it themselves, whatever that is. All my books, 100 Deadly Skills, The Rugged Life, Escape the Wolf, all of them are 100% dedicated to giving you good life skills. And if you don't like reading, well, then you can go join the Ready Room. And the Ready Room is a new little place where I've taken all the skills in the books and turned them into videos. And you can, for a little annual fee, you can get a couple of episodes new every week. And it's and the community is growing. So come join me there in the Ready Room.
Clint Emerson, you're the fucking man, dude.
Hey, you too, man. I appreciate you having me on the show. It's been a badass time. It's actually one of the more fun podcast interviews I've done in a long time.
Thanks, dude. And we'll fucking do this again, man, if you want to get to it.
I'm with you, buddy. You guys do great things. Keep it up.
You do great things, bro. On behalf of the country, brother, thank you. Happy Veterans Day. And man, I hope a lifetime of wealth, success, and friendship. And I hope that we cross paths again. Maybe we'll reach out to you in a little bit and try to do this one more time, if you're cool with that. You're fucking awesome, dude. I love appreciate it, brother. Appreciate
you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Clint, man. Nice meeting you, bro. Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at StreetCop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out StreetCop.com for that offer.